This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel. Hollywood's biggest night of the year is now behind us. In the wake of all the glitz and glam, there's still plenty of celebration and lots of head-scratching as well. Spike Lee won his first competitive Oscar in one of the most emotive moments of the night.
And the Oscar goes to...
Dollhouse! Charlie Wachtel, David Rabinowitz, and Kevin Wilmot, and Spike Lee!
And yet, the aforementioned Spike Lee walked out of the room after Green Book was won Best Picture. That award left many critics wondering when Hollywood will get it right on race. One of the many topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Later on, we'll review new documentaries about musicians Sam Cooke and Teddy Pendergrass and dig into the controversy around Zion Williamson's shoe malfunction. Joining me for all of that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Natalie, welcome back. Good to have
you. Thank you. Good to be here.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Hello, Mark.
Hey, what's up, Frank?
Natalie, this year's Oscars, no host. What'd you make of that night overall?
I stayed with it till the very end. I actually kind of liked the fact that there was no host. I didn't really miss the host. I was very excited about all of the wins for Black folks. And you know, at one point I posted on Instagram, you know, Oscars aren't so white this year. And I think that that's true. I think that's a fair assessment. But, you know, almost as quickly as I thought that maybe something is changing in Hollywood, as soon as they dropped the Best Picture award on Green Book, I turned off the TV immediately because I was like, are you kidding? That just proves, it reinforces that there is this continued tone deafness that's going on in Hollywood, and they don't get it. They do not get it. And it's really, they're paying lip service to diversity and inclusion in a way that is becoming kind of insulting. You know, we're making gains in some places, but it's like we go forward one step to be taken back three. And Green Book as Best Picture is totally exemplary of that.
Mark?
I was happy about the early wins also. You know, I've gotten to the point now where I'm less concerned with the big prizes and more concerned that we're starting to see more representation in what you could argue as the down ballot, you know, races. So to see someone win in costume design, to see, you know, double wins in terms of supporting actress and supporting actor. I'm happy for Mahershala Ali. I'd like for him to get his own starring role so he can get nominated for Best Actor one of these days. It feels like the early days of Denzel Washington's career, right, when he's nominated over and over again, right, really until Malcolm X for these Best Supporting gigs. And he doesn't actually win one, you know, until, you know, 10 years after Malcolm X. But you know, the shows are what they are. I realize that the folks working in the industry need the recognition to be able to get the opportunities. But ultimately, I think for many Black folks, at least, they're meaningless on some sort of level, right? They're never really reflective of what our consumer tastes are, the kinds of things that moved us. You know, I was upset that, for instance, For Real Street wasn't nominated.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, however happy I was about, you know, BlacKkKlansman and Black Panther.
How much of it is about the themes? You know, you talked about Green Book, and of course the controversy here and the puzzle is that this is a story about an important moment in African American cultural history, told through the eyes of a white man, and so there is the tone deafness. On the other hand, if the Academy is handing out these Oscars on the basis of the sort of artistic value, do the themes and the cultural relevance? I mean, where does that fit in the picture of awarding an Oscar? And I'm not saying Green Book was artistically even a better film, but how much do you weigh or do you factor in the theme and the relevance to particular segments of our population when you're making that kind of a vote?
You know, this is the thing. Viggo and Mahershala are extraordinary actors and gave extraordinary performances in the film. So we do have to recognize the artistic value of this, right? And I think we always hope that the Academy Awards can figure out how to do both,
mm-hmm.
right? To reward the artistic value of something, but also to speak to the cultural impact that it can have. The fact you had a movie that not only in many ways disrupts what the actual life is of Dr. Don Shirley, but actually spends very little time talking about the actual Green Book and its significance in the lives of black folks in the early 20th century in the segregated South.
Let's listen to Spike Lee, because he does win an Oscar for the first time, not for Best Director and not Best Film, but certainly for Best Adaptive Screenplay. And let's listen to a little bit of his acceptance speech.
400 years, our ancestors were stolen from Mother Africa and brought to Jamestown, Virginia, enslaved. Our ancestors worked the land from Kansas in the morning, Kansas at night. My grandmother, Zimmy Sheldon Retha, who lived to be 100 years young, who was a Spelman College graduate, even though her mother was a slave. My grandma, who saved 50 years of Social Security checks to put her first grandchild, she called me Spikey Pooh. She put me through Morehouse College and NYU grad film. NYU. Before the world tonight, I give praise to our ancestors who helped build this country and was today, along with the genocide of his native people. The 2020 presidential election is around the corner. Let's all mobilize. Let's all be on the right side of history. Let's do the right thing. You know I had to get that in there.
Oh, of course, Spike Lee, speaking at the Oscars after winning Best Adapted Screenplay for Black Klansman. I'm talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So obviously Spike Lee did manage to get the context into the award ceremony.
He did. I don't know. I am not, like, I was thinking as you were talking about, like, the themes and the artistic, you know, quality, about Roma, you know, which is a beautiful film, but it's problematic in its representation, I think, of, you know, of this Mexican nanny. And even though she is centered, there's still, like, I couldn't get through the film because it was unsettling to me in ways that I couldn't really get to at the moment, at that time when I was watching it. But I just think that there is, Hollywood is still really struggling with how do you merge the two, and how do you, like, you know, something like Green Book, for it not to really address, first of all, the title, and second of all, to center really a secondary person in the story of this amazing musician is a crime. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And so there's a lot that has to be figured out, I think. And I'm just wondering, like, is there a willingness to do that? And when are we going to have more black people that are greenlighting the types of stories that will actually do the work that we're talking about?
Yeah, and of course the criticism is that this is fulfilling, Green Book is fulfilling this Hollywood endless fantasy of assimilation and integration. You know, we're past it, and look, see how good things can be.
Driving Miss Daisy 2.0.
Right. Yeah.
Hey, you talked about the so-called down ballot, Mark. Hannah Beachler and Ruth E. Carter both won for their work in Black Panther, becoming the first African-American women to win Oscars in their categories. Tell us a bit about Ruth Carter.
You know, it's a wonderful story because it's about the longevity, right? When you have a craft and a skill and you're given opportunities, and it's going to take a while before someone picks up on it. So this is a woman who did costume design for Malcolm X in 1992. You know,
and she's Amistad before that, right?
So she's in a 30-year career, and finally it's with this Marvel movie, right? And in fact, she wins the first award for Marvel ever, you know, our first Academy Award for costume design for Black Panther. You know, it's a wonderful moment because, you know, if you're a young person looking at, I want to get involved in movie making in Hollywood, you don't have to be behind the camera and you don't have to be in front of the camera. There's so many other opportunities, and the visibility of someone like Ruth Carter, you know, highlights a place where young folks can think about where they can have an impact on the industry.
To that point, I mean, I was watching the Oscars with my daughter, who is 13, interested in fashion design, you know, trying to figure out what she wants to do. And so she was there watching when Ruth Carter won the award. And I was like, you know, Mimi, this is something that you can aspire to. You don't just have to design fashion. You don't have to, like, that's one way you can live out your dream of designing clothes, but you could also be a costume designer. You know, you could do this type of work. So it was a beautiful thing to see this woman who clearly has had this long career in something that not many, you know, Americans, I think about. Right. You know, we kind of take it for granted. But it does offer opportunity for, as Mark said, young people to think about possibilities and alternatives to, like, the sort of traditional ways of going about things.
And to your point, here's Ruth Carter from last year. Before she won the award, she's talking with Jamal Finkley about what she looks for when she's hiring people to work for her.
And it's not to say that, you know, there's anything, like, mysterious, but when you say to somebody, he's got to look like Uncle Bobby, I kind of want somebody who knows what Uncle Bobby looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
They may have their own version, and I might have a different version, but it's still that uncle that we know.
Ruth E. Carter, winner of the Best Costume Design in this year's Oscars in an interview last year. And that's to your point, who's hiring and who are the gatekeepers, and as that changes, we're going to see maybe more representation.
Hopefully, yeah.
Natalie Bullock Brown is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke, distinguished professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies. It's Back Channel on the State of Things. It's always dramatic when UNC and Duke basketball teams meet up on the court. But just 33 seconds into last week's matchup, there was an even bigger spectacle.
His shoe blew apart. That's unbelievable.
He broke his shoe with his own foot.
Duke star Zion Williamson suffered a sprained knee from the incident, and he's the projected number one pick in the NBA draft. And as such, his shoe malfunction has reopened the conversation about the contradictions of big-time college sports.
These sneaker companies have deals with schools, and these kids have to wear the equipment. As Jalen Rose pointed out on Get Up This Morning, the next time Zion Williamson steps on a court for Duke, he's going to have to put that same brand sneaker on that just exploded on his foot.
Sports commentator Max Kellerman on ESPN. Still with me, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark is James B. Duke, professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. So let's talk about the conversation at Duke anyway, Mark, but elsewhere about the larger conversation this opens up.
You know, this is the thing. You have a young man, because there's all these questions about when Zion is going to return to the court. And again, if he has a catastrophic injury between now and whenever, you know, his opportunity for the kind of fame and rewards, financial rewards that he'll get as a professional will be lost. It's a question that that college basketball players have to consider all the time. And, you know, the shoe thing highlights one part of this, the fact that there were people who paid up to $10,000 to get a ticket to the game, the fact that the former president of the United States was in the audience, Ken Griffey Jr. was there, the fact that this basketball team has played before Beyonce and Jay-Z, LeBron James, and POTUS 44, you know, during the course of the season. You know, we haven't seen this real kind of excitement in college basketball, really, and since Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, you know, back in 1979. So the stakes are very different. And when you look at the amount of money that college sports generates, college basketball in this case, for these institutions, and, you know, there's always the response that, well, you know, they're getting an education out of it. You know, for these young men who are quote unquote one and dones, you know, they're just unlike any other student at Duke at this point in time. To consider them in the same pool is unfair to other Duke students and unfair to them. You know, most of my students aren't doing press conferences four or five times a week. You know, most folks aren't paying $10,000 to see them do what they do as a Duke student. And we're in a situation where, you know, the NBA and NCAA has kicked the can down the road repeatedly. You know, so they wanted to stem the tide of guys going straight from college to the league. So they instituted this one and done rule. And guys who know that they won't be at a school, you know, for more than that year are forced to come to school. Why not give them the opportunity, right, to go directly back into the league? You know, there's a player, Marquise Bolden, who's a junior for Duke's basketball team, who was a top 10 McDonald's All-American coming in, right? He's someone who should have been a one and done, but he's battled through injuries for his first 2 years.
Wow.
So if he would have had the option not to come to college, you know, he might have still got injured, but it'd be a different kind of situation financially for him.
Yeah.
You know, but one of the things that I think Zion Williamson's example really highlights, and Mark was talking about it, you know, all the money that is generated by these athletes playing these sports, you know, really, it made me think about, you know, my alma mater, Northwestern University, and how the football team tried to unionize and how they were like summarily just shut down, right? And, you know, there is a level, well, there's all kinds of reward that can come if a player is allowed to go ahead and you know, be a part of the draft for professional leagues. And I think that there is a real way. I mean, you know, I think William Roden talked about it in Million Dollar Slave,
yeah,
right?
Yep.
That it is the way that these athletes are controlled and contained so that they will make money for their institution, but they can't really make any money for themselves. And then they may just be out of luck if they get injured, and that is a career-ending injury. You know, something that has to change too, because that you're really putting, I think, these athletes, these kids, their careers and their potential on the line in a way that I don't think is fair. And I know that, you know, money is what is motivating these decisions on the part of you know, the different associations that run college sports. But something has to be done that equalizes this playing field, because these kids are making millions of dollars for these schools and they don't get any of it. And they really don't have the opportunity to be educated in a way, because of so much time having to be spent on practice and training and all, and going away to games. Like I've had to teach football players who just don't get, yeah, you know, the same level of education, the same level of opportunity.
It's a wonder we don't have an amateur sports league and we don't conflate the two. There are a lot of good reasons why we would like to pay for publicly the education of children from the United States of America. And then there's a market that says, I will pay a lot to see a basketball game. Why
right.
those two aren't on separate channels, I don't quite understand.
There's two things I want to say. One, you know, most of the coaches for these top tier, both football and basketball programs, their salaries are backstop by these shoe companies. You know, some of that $10 million is going from Nike to Duke. Some of that is going to backstop Coach K's salary, mm-hmm. right? So that's the first part of it. The second piece of it, that the way that we talk about these young men in and of itself is racist, right? There's a feeling that if they spend a year or two in college, they become more seasoned, they become more socialized, that they're not mature enough to be able to be successful. But yet we know that there are tennis players who turn pro at 15. We know that there are golf players who turn pro at 15. Major League Baseball players, most of them go directly from high school into paid positions in the minor leagues. If they do come to college, they're only at college for a year or two. Very rarely do they stay for 4 years before, you know, they get drafted into the big leagues. So to think about somehow that these black men are different,
right.
are unique, that they don't have the ability to be successful at 17 and 18 years old the way, let's say, Pete Sampras was, mm-hmm. you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Let's turn now to a new installment of the Netflix music docuseries Remastered that focuses on the life of Sam Cooke. And I want to listen to a clip from the trailer.
There was a sense in the music industry that Sam was getting too powerful.
Who would want to shoot Sam Cooke?
There are a lot of people who believe that there was some sort of cover-up.
People deeply felt that the FBI was somehow involved.
When I found out Sam Cooke, Muhammad Ali, and Malcolm X were all connected, I said, what a huge threat to America.
That's a clip from the trailer of Two Killings of Sam Cooke, an installment of the music docuseries Remastered. I am here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, you actually were in this film. I cut that clip off just before you would have said something, as a matter of fact.
It's Netflix has this wonderful series called Remastered, where they do a deep dive into the lives of, you know, some of these popular musicians. So they've done one on Bob Marley, Johnny Cash, Run DMC, and for Black History Month, they launched the one, The Two Killings of Sam Cooke. Wonderful job by the director, Kelly Duane, that looks at Sam Cooke, obviously, as this great entertainer and fabulous singer, but does for the first time, I think, in any documentary done about him, look at his background as a civil rights activist, as a militant thinker in the mainstream, and particularly his relationship with Malcolm X and Jim Brown and Muhammad Ali, which many folks did not know, you know, until they got a chance to see the documentary.
Natalie, you said you didn't know much about Sam Cooke's activism until you saw the film. What was your reaction?
I mean, I was thrilled. I mean, I have always loved Change Gonna Come by Sam Cooke. And, you know, really, I've only known, like, or been familiar with a few of his songs. And so, I kind of know he was a heartthrob. You know, I know, like, these sort of tangential details about him. But to find out that there was this depth to this man who, you know, for my generation was... you know, of a time that was sort of fleeting. You know, he's really my parents', you know, music. I was thrilled, but I was also like disgusted, like I was with Mr. Soul, because I didn't know this. And I feel like it's so important to know these, know the three dimensionality of these icons, these legends of our culture. And I just felt like he had the promotion, the marketing of Sam Cooke has been similar to that of Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and John Hope Franklin, where they're really tamped down. We just get the sort of, oh, you know, let's sing Kumbaya part of, you know, what people want them to be. But Sam Cooke was much more than that.
Well, we get a sense of the depth of his commitment and his understanding of the history and the weight of the moment in this conversation when they're talking in the film about singer Jesse Belvin. He had performed at the first integrated performance in Arkansas, and then he died in a head-on crash immediately after that concert.
Jesse Belvin, his wife, and three other people died. At first, we thought it was just an accident, but later, we found out that his tie had been cut by some locals in the area. Of course, it was a message.
I think Sam sort of saw that potential and wanted him to be a bigger star. And in that sort of terrible way, he was just sort of cut down. He was gone. So now he wasn't just carrying Emmett Till. Now he was also carrying Jesse Belvin with him and the things that he wanted to do and the ways that he wanted to break down racism.
Musician Billy Davis and Boston Globe Associate Editor Renee Graham on the Netflix music doc Remastered, The Two Killings of Sam Cooke. I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So tell us, Mark, more about the significance of that moment.
So, you know, Jesse Belvin is dealing, as most of these artists were, dealing with the Chitlin Circuit, places where black performers would perform mainly for black audiences, but very often when they perform for integrated audiences, it was a little bit more complex, right? There was either a split down the middle of the aisle in the front, or there were black folks up in the stands and white folks on the ground. And, you know, there was always an unspoken law when you went down south that you wouldn't perform for these integrated audiences. And Jesse Belvin did. And so when he gets killed afterwards, and many folks see it as you know, payment for him crossing the line, you know, it reverberates to a lot of these artists about, you know, whether or not they were going to continue doing this kind of work. And Sam Cooke, as did Ray Charles and a few other artists, were very clear that they would no longer perform for segregated audiences. They would only perform for audiences that were truly integrated.
And there was a real showdown, and that moment is illustrated when Sam Cooke says he's not going to do it. Some of the artists who said
they were with him, but then when push comes to shove, right, you know.
Shows you how dramatic the moment was. But then you make the point, and this is what I cut out of the trailer, because I want you to say it now. I mean, the fact is he did cross over, and he was exceptionally popular with white and black audiences, and that's probably the thing that scared people the most.
Yeah, I mean, he's complicated in that regard, in that he knew how to speak to these very different publics. So think about a song like You Send Me, which is its only number one pop song. You know, that was a song that crossed over. You know, white America loved that song. But then you listen to an album like Live at the Harlem Square, and this is his gift, right, you know, to the black audience. It's a grittier Sam Cooke, and he knew how to be able to bleed those two things together in ways that you see reverberate now in terms of black mainstream artists, their ability to talk to a mainstream white public and also still, you know, be able to speak directly to black audiences.
And the point you made in the film is that the greatest threat was the fact that Sam Cooke is in America.
Right. They're still getting to know who Malcolm X is. Right. They're still getting to know Jim Brown. They still get to know know Malcolm X, but, you know, they know who.
And as you say, Muhammad Ali, the great moment in the film where they have actual archival footage of Muhammad Ali and Sam Cooke doing a duet.
Well, this, I want to give you a little introduction. Only this record is talking about, you know, me, the greatest, and the various people in countries such as England and Paris. And we'll give them a sound.
Come on, let's give them a sound.
We'll do a lot better if we had the music here with us.
All right, we're going to do it.
We're trying now.
Hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, the gang's all here. We're going to swing as one.
There it is, footage of the duet between Muhammad Ali and Sam Cooke featured in the new Netflix music documentary Remastered. Natalie, what did you make of that moment?
I mean, I loved it. Muhammad Ali is such a example of someone who, you know, really thought deeply and was very steeped in his values. Like, you know, he was not going to compromise, but he was fun and as great as he was, you know, he knew everybody and was loved by so many people. And it, I think what struck me the most is that all of these people were alive at the same time. You know, it's a Sam Cooke and Malcolm X and, you know, I just forgot his name. But, you know, all of these people that we consider to be iconic today were, you know, just like hanging out with each other at a really challenging time in our history. And, you know, in their own way, addressing the same issues.
But we don't imagine Muhammad Ali just hanging out with his friends because every time we see him on the news, he's being aggressive. He's doing what he does best, which is punching people out, scaring white audiences even more, right? I mean, he is the quintessential fearful black body. But again, always in a role. And here they're in this very different role. They're
different
hanging
role,
around.
Yeah, Sam Cooke produces the album for him. But, you know, Ali wins the fight against Sonny Liston in Miami. And they go back to the black-owned Hampton Hotel in Miami. And the only people who are there are Ali and his family, Malcolm X, Jim Brown, and Sam Cooke. And that's a kind of intimacy around black masculinity that we have so few examples of in the mainstream.
So let's talk a little bit, because the documentary does delve into the idea that murder may have been, it was a murder. I mean, Sam Cooke was murdered. But the details of that murder have never been fully explored.
Yeah, and you know, you watch that and you don't come away with any more conclusions other than what had been rumored and suggested in the past. What we know is that, you know, he posed a political threat. The FBI was doing surveillance on Malcolm X and Ali, and in their own words, they talk about a famous Negro entertainer or singer, and they're talking about Sam Cooke. We know that he's making moves in terms of a record company and ownership of his masters and things like that. You know, the R&B, the underbelly of R&B meant that most of the distribution and things like that went through the mob, right? And when you talk about a role in terms of being independent in that role in time, you know, that's a threat, you know, to a place where they're generating income, and that was going to raise eyebrows also. There's a scene where, you know, they talk about him getting a call from Sammy Davis Jr., you know, telling him, it's like, you probably need to chill a little bit because these folks are real serious about this.
Yeah, and I don't know if we heard that, but the fact is he owned his own label.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
SAR
and,
Records.
And so he's got some ownership. All right, let's start this now and then talk more about it later. The Showtime documentary, Teddy Pendergrass, If You Don't Know Me, chronicles the life of the singer from his childhood in Philadelphia to his rise in fame as a singer with first Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes and then on his own. Let's hear a clip.
I Miss You, that was our first record. And we got in the studio and then I started like doing, you know, and he said, oh, that's it.
Not only was he good looking, but he had a presence and he had a special voice.
The clip from the Showtime documentary, Teddy Pendergrass, If You Don't Know Me. And I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, I believe you were swooning.
Oh, yeah. I was. I mean, Teddy is so interesting to me because I feel like I've known him all my life. And in a way that is kind of unlikely, I think, because I'm from Chicago, and in middle school and high school, house music was like the soundtrack of my life. And that's how I learned about Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, because Bad Love was like one of the jams. It was a classic as far as house music was concerned. So I learned about Teddy, I think, probably a lot earlier than I would have. By the time I was a teenager and a teenager, because he had the accident in 82. So I guess I was 13 years old, and I was very familiar with I Miss You. And I mean, just the radio at that time, right. Like black radio at that time was so soulful in a way that, you know, we've lost in many ways. So I knew all of these Harold Melvin and Blue Note songs. I knew Teddy's, you know, songs from his first album. I knew his hits. He was bad. He was amazing.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Back Channel today with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. We were talking about the Showtime documentary Teddy Pendergrass, If You Don't Know Me. And Mark, the film tracks his relationship with the police. Talk about that, because this also parallels stories of other black artists at the time.
You know, when you are a very well-known black artist who may not be as well-known to the mainstream, and you show up and you drive in a green Rolls Royce and you're wearing fur coats and you have this expansive mansion, you know, just out, you know, this outside of the city of Philadelphia, it's going to raise eyebrows, right? And again, we're still talking in the mid-1970s, so that there still are these very difficult relationships. You know, this is, what, a couple of years before the, you know, Philadelphia Police Department bombs move and their relationship with that organization. So, you know, Teddy Pendergrass is not protected from any of that animus in that point in time. And, you know, there's a way in which, you know, we know Teddy Pendergrass's songs. I mean, his sound, his voice is as recognizable as anything you would have heard on black radio and even mainstream radio, you
and
know, in the 70s and 80s,
I mean,
and commercials.
Those beer commercials. Right.
Yeah. And he also, and his break, so trouble with the police. In fact, he had filed a lawsuit against the Philadelphia police. So there was a lot of trouble with that and all that you said. Then he breaks with Harold Melvin and he goes on his own. Harold Melvin is not happy with him and issues threats as well. So there's a lot going on. Let's listen to more from the trailer from the Showtime documentary.
That was a lot of thug life in the record industry at that time. He didn't know who his friends were or who his enemies were.
There were so many pieces to him.
What a complicated guy.
If you have a certain amount of fame and money, you think nothing can happen to you. And what happened to him was the cruelest of all.
It's a clip from the trailer from the Showtime documentary Teddy Pendergrass, If You Don't Know Me. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Then there was a terrible accident that he got into. It paralyzed him, and of course a lot of theories about that and about whether or not that was really an accident, Natalie.
I appreciated the way that the film addressed that, because it was, you know, I was like, okay, I heard one thing, right? And the way that the story is told, and in particular told from the perspective or told by the woman who was in the car with
Teddy.
Tanika
Watson.
Yeah. She's trans, right? But I was like, maybe they got the story wrong. I mean, and there was something really interesting to me about how Tanika talks about what happened and then reveals. It's like after we find out what has happened to Teddy, we hear about the accident and he is, you know, taken away to the hospital. Then the reveal of, or actually it's actually a couple of scenes later, I think, but it takes a while to reveal that Tanika actually was in the process of transitioning at that time. And I thought that was really clever, because there was so much gossip at the time about what Teddy was doing in the car and who was doing what to him in the car when he crashed, you know, that I really appreciated. I thought it was a very respectful and classy yeah. way to deal with what at the time was a very like inflamed situation.
And Teddy Pendergrass was the alpha male of black music at that point in time. His first five solo albums go platinum. He's the first black male artist to ever do that. And so when the rumors came out afterwards about speculation about the accident, this idea of this hyper-masculinity that we had signed to yeah. Teddy Pendergrass
yeah.
disappears, right?
Yeah.
And it literally returns in this broken body.
That's right.
Right, that can't in some ways function the way that it had functioned before. And so it becomes a whole different conversation, not just about the loss of the music or the quality of the music as we had come to know it, but also some real questions about black masculinity
Absolutely.
In that context.
Yep.
And the fact that, you know, Tanika Watson in 1982, you know, we're not having conversations about trans anybody,
at
right?
all.
I mean, there's a way in which the fact that she was in the documentary is important because it allows her to come in from the cold, right? She has not had a voice in this at all because folks didn't quite know how to deal with her and her body and what she represented.
Yeah. But I love what Mark is saying about the, you know, having to re-examine this man who just totally, I mean, the alpha male of black masculinity is so perfect because, yeah, I mean, it's like Teddy was it, you know, he was the pinnacle of what it means to be virile and sexy and all these things. And so when he does reemerge in this brokenness, right, I think it was really difficult for me as, you know, a consumer of his music and just audiences in general to reconcile that. But, I mean, I think there is also so much love for him and a respect for the fact that he really pulled himself up out of the pits of hell to come back and make music again. And didn't he have his first gold album, after the accident? So, you know, it's really a triumph story.
Yeah, and in the pits of hell, he almost didn't come back. And,
that's right.
And a lot of people pulled him through, and then he realized that he can do it. And then it becomes a remarkable story about how he came back and brought himself back from all of that, went through a major depressive period, considered suicide, eventually did sing again, and made his return to the stage at Live Aid in 1985. Let's listen to a clip from that performance.
I am truly grateful to be here today. And I want you to know I feel your love. Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place if you can. Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place.
A clip from the Showtime documentary Teddy Pendergrass, If You Don't Know Me. And I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So talk about, Mark, his recovery and what his career was like after the accident.
I remember actually watching that live on television as a 19-year-old. You know, it was a perfect comeback on this wide stage. You know, Live Aid did all these performances in different locations, so one of them were in Philadelphia, so it was natural. He came on stage with Ashford and Simpson, who, of course, wrote the song, you know, for Diana Ross, you know, years earlier. Mm-hmm. His career is already, you know, by that time he had dropped two albums. He wasn't the Teddy Pendergrass that we knew. The voice was a little different, mm-hmm. but he had found a space to be successful, right? And found a record label and Elektra that was willing to support him. One of the tragedies of the accident is at the time that he has the accident, he basically is the only artist on Philadelphia International Records. So mm-hmm. he's literally propping up the label. And so they didn't have the resources really to take care of him in any way. And they were releasing albums and stuff, throwaway stuff that had been in the can just to generate some income. But Elektra took an opportunity, and the fact that he embraced the idea that he was now a paraplegic, right? I'm willing to go on stage and be in the wheelchair and make sure the audience sees me. Actually goes on tour, you know, in that situation. It is a remarkable story of resilience, you know, that he was able to be as successful as he was. In fact, you know, every year for the NCAA tournament, he did a version of One Shining Moment, you know, the song that they played in the tournament, and his is one of the most popular ones that was done.
That Live Aid performance is striking to me because I was watching in the documentary, and I'm like, where are the black people? I don't see any black people in the audience. I mean, but that speaks to how popular Teddy was.
But you remember, you know, Ashford and Simpson, Teddy Pendergrass, and Run DMC, I want to say, were the only black, and Sade, were the only black acts for Live Aid.
For Live Aid, right.
Let's turn now to talk about the BET docudrama American Soul, about the rise and fall of Don Cornelius and the dance show Soul Train. I want to start with a clip from the trailer.
You're just in time for the first trip on the Soul Train. If the sound of soul is your pleasure, then what's your treasure?
Soul
Mr. Cornelius, these kids are nailing all the latest steps.
Maybe you don't understand. I need stars creating the next dance craze.
You ain't American Bandstand. Come back when you learn the game.
The dancers there are stars around town.
I'm talking about a national television show written, produced, and owned by black folks.
Clip from the trailer, American Soul, a new BET drama about Don Cornelius, the creator of Soul Train. I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, remind us who Don Cornelius is.
Don, founder and longtime host of the television program Soul Train, and revolutionized the presentation of soul music, black music, you know, to the mainstream public.
Came out of your hometown, Chicago.
Absolutely.
A local show, and decided to take it national.
Yep.
With
yep.
like $400.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, I guess I was too young to have auditioned to be one of the dancers. I wouldn't have made it. I'm going to let you know that right now. But, you know, it was definitely a point of pride that Soul Train came out of Chicago. And I think the black community really rallied around the local broadcast of it.
And the dancers as well. Yeah, talk about that. I mean, what struck you about the portrayal of that? I mean, the fact that there was a focus in the film.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that, because I, you know, Soul Train is nothing without the dancers in a lot of respects, but you don't think about their stories, right. You know, and what it took for them to actually get on the show. And even what happened, like what were their aspirations? Were they there just to dance, or were they actually using it as a springboard to get somewhere else?
And Mark, it was also a commentary on the times. I mean, it's a fabulous time capsule. I want to listen to another cut. This actually features actor Cynqua Walls, who plays the character Don Cornelius. And he's talking about his role and what he thinks the impact of this show is.
We touch on MLK's assassination.
Yes.
But what's interesting for a lot of people is they'll study that in the history books and know that it happened. Mm-hmm. But how did it affect the social climate at that time?
Yes.
How did it affect people really living in it? And then how is that manifested today? We do that in the show.
Yes.
Because you'll be able to see it where it wasn't like MLK was a historical figure that wasn't reachable by you because mm-hmm. of the time.
Yes.
These people were dealing with it. And this is how it affected Don. This is how it affected Brienne. Like, this is how it affected all these characters
yes.
in real time if you were living in that moment.
Yeah.
That's actor Cynqua Walls, who plays Don Cornelius in the BET series American Soul. He was talking with WGN Radio Studios. Mark, talk a little bit about that. I mean, this Showtime show itself and the impact it has to sort of recapture that moment in American history.
I give BET a lot of credit. They have found their voice, if you will,
yeah.
between the new edition series and the Bobby Brown series right. and now with American Soul. You know, Dick Darkness is someone that a lot of folks knew but didn't know. So to hear the backstories and see the backstories of how he was able to create this show is really important, because it actually is a commentary on how difficult it was to mount black programming in that particular era, right? To think about Soul Train along with Soul,
right?
You know, these are two different places. One is, you know, commercial television. The other one is public television.
Yeah.
But it's the same kind of struggles, right? Mainstream folks who don't believe in it, advertisers who don't believe in it, black folks who have a certain kind of weight in the industry but don't know whether or not you're going to be around a year from now. Like that fascinating conversation with Don Cornelius and Diana Ross. It's like, I love what you're doing, but, you know, you're going to have to keep coming at me in order for this to be able to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought you were going to say you were going to mention the conversation between Don Cornelius and Gladys Knight, because yeah. when he approaches her in the series, you know, she's skeptical as well. But I want to just big up Kelly Rowland.
Oh, my God.
As Gladys Knight. I mean, I was not expecting her to, number one, be such a good and convincing actress, and she almost channels Gladys Knight.
I mean, she has all the gestures. I mean, she, yeah.
Yeah, and but I also want to just point out that I think it was a really smart move on BET's part or whoever the producers were that were hired to do this for BET, to not have at least Kelly Rowland lip sync Gladys Knight, and that she actually sang the songs as herself. It felt more authentic in that way than if she had been, you know, because we would have known that she was lip syncing, you know, because we know, you know, if you're familiar with Kelly Rowland, you know her voice. But I was just astonished by her performance.
Or the choice to cast, you know, well-known stars in those roles. So Kelly Rowland Michelle Williams as Donna Russ, Bobby Brown as Rufus Thomas.
And Kelly Price.
And Kelly.
What about the significance of the show itself in real time and its impact on American culture in general?
Soul Train?
Yeah.
I mean, there's many folks. I mean, Soul Train had the impact in terms of mainstream and black music to white audiences that AM radio had back in the 1950s. Like these kids waking up on a Saturday morning who don't know much about black music, but the cartoons have just gone off and they're looking for something else to watch, and they come across these black bodies doing these amazing dances. So by the time you look at Soul Train in the late 1970s, it has all these major advertisers, right? It is challenging American Bandstand to the extent that Dick Clark creates a show modeled after Soul Train. It only lasts for a year to try to compete with Soul Train. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've only got a couple of minutes left. I want to talk very briefly about Jussie Smollett, that story, and how it's being received, and get your take on it, Mark.
You know, it's difficult because we still have this moment where we don't want to believe victims. But for many of us, the nature of the crime resonates in very powerful ways, and our longstanding mistrust of the Chicago Police Department also speaks to that. I think the story, more than anything, is a commentary on what happens when crimes may or may not have occurred and you have an untrustworthy partner, right, in terms of the Chicago Police Department to try to figure out the truth of the situation.
Yeah. Natalie?
I couldn't say it better. I mean, I just think that there's a lot to be learned from this situation. I appreciate the fact that I think there were a lot of people that wanted to rush to the aid of Jussie and to believe him. But I also think it's very striking that, you know, once there was even a kernel of doubt that what he was saying was true, you know, there was also just as quick a rush to distance, you know, for people to distance themselves from whatever support they were offering him. So, you know, we still have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, part of my concern was that the story took up so much space, right? So at the time that we're talking about this story, there literally is a white man in D.C. collecting arms, right? Someone who's in the armed services collecting arms to start a race war to shoot black folks. And we're not having any conversations about that because we're trying to figure out whether or not Jussie Smollett was telling the truth.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke, Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, author and host of the webcast Left of Black, Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Thank you so much for being
here. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the latest edition of Back Channel. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jenny Lawson, engineering today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.